Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. My name is BJ Siasogal, and I'm here with Academy Award-winning filmmaker Ryan Silbert. Hi, Ryan. Ryan is a writer, producer, author, and founder of Origin Story Entertainment, a multi-platform entertainment company with a global focus on storytelling. Ryan, you've done all kinds of great work. As a founder, you're currently in development on television, film, and immersive narratives, projects created specifically for audio platforms. I could go on and on the work that you've done with Spike Lee, with Stan Lee as well, too. But I want to just welcome you to the program first and say hello.
Thank you, BJ. Thanks for having me. This is really fun.
Love it. So I'll get first things first out of the way. This is a Cornell podcast, so I want to talk about some of our favorite Cornell stuff. Can you tell me, Ryan, when was the first time that you fell in love with Cornell?
When they let me in. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Opening up that envelope is like the best, you know, experience you can get as a Cornellian. So I think that would be the moment. But I think that in terms of just like really falling in love, I felt like the community really invites you in during the what is it called? Cornell Days? Is that still what it's called?
Cornell Days.
And it really creates a bond, not only with like other Cornellians that are, or potential future Cornellians that you're going to go to school with, but also like their families. Like, and it becomes like a very nice way into, to be introduced to university. So I felt like that was when I really realized that like Cornell is like a warm place and not just like what you would think of as like an institutional, a place of institutional learning, you know, which feels a little, cold, you know, and I think Cornell is the opposite of that, although it gets physically cold.
Yeah, I think one of my, the Ithaca Is shirts, one of them I saw was Ithaca Is Cold the other time. And I'm like, yeah, that hits it right on the head. But I would agree with you there too, right? The community at Cornell really brings people in, and it's a good sense of warmth in there too. Is there a favorite place that you always have to go to whenever you're back in Ithaca?
Yes, but I like to just walk the streets and I sort of channel memories of what existed and was there, because the turnover has really been quite significant in Ithaca over the last couple of years, but or at least since I graduated. But in terms of like where I really like to go, I have very good memories of just because I lived on West Campus when freshmen still lived on West Campus. And I just have good memories of standing right outside, you know, looking over the hill, you know, down to West Campus and looking even further out and just thinking, oh, if I kept going that direction, that's Florida. This is before Google Maps. I've since learned that is not South, but it's okay. In my mind, it'll always be South. And I thought like, well, it always felt like the world was very expansive and you could see so far from up there. And then you could look down and see your home or your dorms. And I always have a good feeling standing there. And I think a lot of people do and have a different experiences in that little area. But yeah.
I love it. That's very cool. Yeah, it's the conversations I've had on this podcast before too. It's funny to see, you know, what our world is like now versus when we were as students and how different things would be if we were students currently, at this time as well too. So talking about kind of, the current world, so you know, you're the founder of Origin Story Entertainment. I love the description of hearing it be immersive narratives, created specifically for our audio platforms, and those development things as well too. Could you talk a little about your work and the things that you love, and what does your work currently entail today?
It's like a hard question. You know, it's one of the, I have one of those jobs, and I'm very fortunate to have it, and it's a real privilege because, you know, you get to tell stories and live in your imagination for a lot of it. But it is sort of like my greatest fear is going to Thanksgiving dinner with friends and family, and you have to describe, like, everybody says, like, what are you working on now? Or like, what are you doing? And it's just so complicated. Like, no one asks the heart surgeon, like, how was the surgery yesterday? You know? And then I always wanted like a simple answer. But you know, ultimately it's all about storytelling for me. And I come at it from various points of view. I had a varied background. I did not start in film and television and storytelling at all. I started in marketing. But I really applied a lot of storytelling, my storytelling interests to my marketing and brand work, which allowed me then to position and transition over to, you know, being a storyteller myself. And that's something I think, you know, even dates back to Cornell and part of like why going to a liberal arts university and a university that has so many aspects to it and not like a technical school is valuable for somebody like me because, and I encourage people to do that because you can explore all sorts of different interests and people don't hire me or aren't interested in the stories I have to tell because I'm like good at the craft of screenwriting or whatever. Like they're interested in me because I can bring, you know, a unique perspective or something that interests me. And like my interests are pretty wide. Like I'm interested in biotech. I'm interested in history. I'm interested in medicine. And I'm interested in, you know, how human behavior works. And in, at Cornell, I was able to explore a lot of those things, not just in my major, but outside of it. And then like later in life, like you don't really realize it, but it's kind of the classes and courses that you think don't have any quote unquote like value, you know what I mean? Come back to as like one of the greatest tools in my arsenal sometimes. And that's, and that curiosity is what you can stimulate at school. And I think that's, that curiosity is what stimulates my work now. So, I mean, what I'm working on is usually things that I'm curious about. So, project, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh yeah. I love that. I mean, I think curiosity is a common thread I hear amongst Cornellians as well too. It's just, they're curious about the world around them. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, the experiences that you had at Cornell? What did you study and how did that translate into the curiosity, you know, your first work in marketing and now in your company as well?
So Origin Story is really set up to be a place where, you know, it's a production company, you know, for my interests really. And we own our own intellectual property that then we're able to bring out into the world in different forms. And we're very nimble in that way. And I think what I studied at Cornell, because I mean, I guess it's what I find, like, I think it happens a lot when I talk to students that are there now is like, you're always a product of the time you live in plus sort of like the base mechanics of what education can bring you, because education can change, but it's much slower to change. And I think Cornell tends to be on the cutting edge of making those changes, but some things are just the basics, like sort of the block and tackle educational elements. And then you apply your, the context of the world you live in to it. So for instance, like, you know, I was a comm major in Cal's, but at the time, you know, it was right before the internet bubble burst, and I was interested in interactive communication because, again, I was interested in people and how we were going to interact with each other, both with storytelling, but also through marketing and brands or whatever it is. And I created my own sort of sub or my own focus within the comm department because, you know, as you probably know, BJ, you know, Cornell's very open to if you have a really strong passion or idea, and like it was very early. It was a little harder then, but now with all of the stuff I learned here about with e-learning and the entrepreneurial efforts that Cornell puts together now, it's pretty wild what you can do if you have an interest. And I think it's about applying both the knowledge you can learn from a teacher and from books and good mentorship and your instinctual context that you bring as a young person into the world. Because, you know, it's not like, you know, I don't live in a business where having gray hair matters so much, you know? and it comes from living, you know, like a lot, it comes from your life experience. It's part of why, you know, we hear a lot about our struggle in the film business, particularly in all businesses, but really in the film business, particularly around diversity and diverse voices. And it's true because that is what brings, and it's not much a diverse thought too. And I think that's where, places like Cornell and like kind of the classes and the way that the courses are kind of built and structured help people in their business lives later. And I hear that a lot from friends now that I've met at Cornell or who went to Cornell that I didn't know then, and, you know, from different generations. It's kind of sounds similar. You're on the podcast. I'm curious to hear if that's something you hear from your guests.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something, so the few episodes that I've recorded so far, we talk about this whole idea of intersectionality. So, you know, we had someone talk about like sustainability and how that relates in the D&I space. Someone talking about museums and its interactions in the D&I space. And I think here you know, film and media as well too, and hearing the intersection, especially, you know, your work is storytelling, right? So what are the stories that are being told and what are the stories not being told? I think that's always an interesting play in that space as well. In your search for stories to tell, you know, what makes a good story in your opinion? How do you find these unique stories?
Oh, well, I mean, I think everybody has a story to tell. I think it's about how you choose to tell it to a certain degree. And I think what's nice about the kind of times we live in, while they can be challenging in a lot of ways, there are now ways of getting your voice heard and discovered, you know, whether it's through podcasting or, you know, even an internet presence. I mean, I don't know that the influencer culture will be able to be sustainable, but yeah. The idea that you can create something that's passionate, that you're passionate about and find an audience for it, shows that I think it just demonstrates what we've all sort of known, but haven't had the resources to be able to democratize the distribution methods, is to, you know, people want to hear different sorts of stories and don't necessarily want to be mass fed. Nothing that there's anything wrong with, you know, big massive budget movies or books or television series, because, you know, those bring a different aspect. And I think what's nice about those is that those create like a communal aspect. Like, we can all rally around, you know, the Avengers, even if the stakes are pretty low. Because, I mean, you know that the Avengers, for the most part, are going to be making movies for the next 20,
I don't know, that
years.
Thanos snap, you never know.
Yeah. I mean, I could figure out a pretty good use for that snap every now and then.
I think you bring up an interesting point, though, right? So with the democratization of voices, more voices can be heard. But then also, what are the common stories that unite us all together as well, too? Could you talk a little about that in your work? You know, what are some of the drawbacks that you see with, you know, just segmentation in your industry versus, you know, things that we all rally around and will be things we all get excited about?
Yeah, I think that there's something interesting that's going on now. So I do a lot of work now in audio, and this is an audio podcast, so it's a good place to talk about this, I think, is what's becoming, and I'm noticing this, because when you create something, one of my mentors was George Romero, and I'm working with his former wife on a couple of projects now. And, you know, he had this, he was one of the pioneers of punk rock filmmaking and democratization, and nothing would keep him from making a movie. Obviously, he made this movie with a bunch of friends in 68, Night of Living Dead. And he talked about when the iPhone was, and, you know, he's no longer with us, but unfortunately, but when the iPhone came out, he looked at it and people were complaining that the iPhone is so small and that's how we're going to consume movies. And, you know, George made a very good point. He was like, I've been editing, because, you know, back in the day when you edited analog and you wanted to edit a movie, you cut and spliced the film together. And in order to splice it together, you looked at it through a microscope or magnifying glass, because, you know, the film is, it's a film reel. And you would cut them physically. So this, and the size wasn't much bigger than an iPhone. So he's been seeing his movies at that size. And so is every filmmaker for forever. Now the idea is, though, you always had it in your mind that you're going to see it on the screen, in a communal environment. You kind of knew what the audience were delivering for and how they were going to consume it. So with audio podcasts, particularly with that storytelling, I think what's kind of fascinating about it is that you bring a whole other sensory experience to it, because you don't know where your listener is going to experience the story. And I don't do nonfiction. At the moment, I don't have any nonfiction audio podcasts out, but, With a fictional podcast, they could be listening to it in pieces or binging it. They could be listening to it on the beach, or they could be, on a run, you know, and that brings a different kind of memory to it. And I find that when I consume my content that way, I start having new sensory experiences, to my point about looking at Florida off of the, off of the chimes. It's I think about, if I get into it, there's certain benches on the West Side Highway in New York that I think about, it brings back memories of certain stories that I've heard. So it's if I'm listening to a Stephen King novel, I'm like, oh wow, that's for some reason I connect audio and my physical presence now in a different way. And that's, I think, very immersive, to use a different way of thinking of immersion than virtual reality, because it creates audio. I think audio is a very powerful memory tool. So.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, that's always what's fascinating for me about podcasts. You mentioned a little bit too, you never know where the listener is going to be when they're listening to a podcast. And I feel like that's a very unique challenge than a film, where people are going to be in a movie theater most of the time, right? Or in the comfort of their home nowadays, they'll be in a place. What's been, when you produce audio podcasts now, How do you work with that challenge, you know, thinking about where the person's going to be whenever they experience the story that you're trying to tell?
It doesn't necessarily impact how you tell the story, because the story, you know, I'm the first audience for the thing I'm writing. So it doesn't make sense to me. Then, you know, that's a problem. Or yep. My producer's the first audience, or, you know, it's because I've worn a lot of hats in the creative space. And I don't always produce, I don't always write, I don't always direct. You know, what I've been told, and like, this is sort of through mentorship that I've learned, is like, it's really helpful. Like, when you're creating a single idea, it's all yours. You're both the production designer, the writer, the actor, you're everything. And then you hire better people every time. So like, who are better than you at that. So I'll hire a better writer than me if I'm producing something, or I'll hire a better producer than I could produce than, you know, if I'm writing something or whatever it might be. Right. So, you know, for me, when we're creating stories, it's really just about, you know, the story. It's not really about where you're going to experience it. And I think now more than ever, it doesn't matter. Like, that truly doesn't matter now. And I think of the way, because it doesn't, but the economics still matter. Like, that's where things are a little bit nice. Like, it's trying to figure out how you get things financed. And you know, the size of the project versus how the release is going to, you know, how it's going to be exhibited or experienced. But, you know, sometimes it's not really my decision.
Yeah. you mentioned, again, I love hearing, you know, you've worn a lot of hats in your career, everything, you know, from producing to writing, all that. What's been your favorite hat to wear, and what's the hat you'd like to go back to?
Oh, man, I always say I'm like the worst CEO, but like, I'm a pretty like decent intern. So I would like, you know, maybe I'm the only person that's ever done this. I have no use for LinkedIn, really. I have a very limited usage for LinkedIn, because I'm not like looking for a job necessarily always. And it's such a good platform for that. And I just have very limited experience with it. It's like not the social media of my choice. But every now and then I'll browse, and somehow I'm on ZipRecruiter's mailing list. And I find that really fun, because ZipRecruiter somehow has me on their mailing list, and they've defined what job I should have. And I like fantasize about these jobs I get sent, because I'm like,
what are these jobs? I'm curious now. What does ZipRecruiter feel like you should be doing?
Sometimes it'll be like, I should look at every morning I get one. Sometimes it'll be normal. Like, it'll say like, oh, you'd be a good documentary filmmaker. I'm like, well, thank you, ZipRecruiter. Like, thank you so much. Like, and you know, you could work at this company. And then I find out about new companies that way. I don't know. It's like, for me, that's like, almost like meditative, because it gives me a glimpse at looking at, because I work in a very small environment, you know. Yeah. It's not like I'm running a 500 person organization. So it's nice to be able to like fantasize what that could be like. I had that, you know, when I worked in marketing and with brands, you know, we had big meetings, and obviously I worked with big companies, but I kind of fantasize, I kind of miss that dynamic, and particularly the water cooler moments, because now I also don't know what to watch on television, which is very, very frustrating, because on Monday morning, I got up, and I talked to like, you know, Brandy, but like, it's not like that many people for me to interact with. And I'm thinking, like, I don't know what everybody's watching. Like, I was last to Cheer, you know, like Cheer was amazing, but like, everybody was talking about it when they had like actual Monday morning jobs, and I don't have that. So I miss that.
I think, you know, that harkens back to what I was asking you about earlier too, you know, right? Like the segmentation versus the big things that we talk about. It's the same with like our virtual spaces. We're trying to figure that out with my work. A lot of us work remotely now. We're like, where do we congregate and just not have a meeting about work, but just connect as human beings? That's a little bit lost. And I think from those times, you can often get new ideas for work, just because you're just talking about something tangentially different in that space.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Tell me what you're watching on Mondays, please.
I'll do that. So I'll send you that message. Like, here's what I'm watching this Monday.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I will say, so a segue for me, you know, your latest project, Stanley's Alliances, Trick of the Light. It's an original audio storytelling event produced by Amazon's Audible Studios, and also starring Gronish's Yara Shahidi. Super awesome. I'm excited. I'm going to add that actually to my audio list now at this point as well. Could you tell me a little bit, how did you get involved in this project? How did that start out?
Oh, man. So, again, it's one of those fun things where, like, if you're passionate about something, you know, never give up that passion. And it wasn't very cool to, like, go to comic store, especially in college. So I, like, sneak away and, like, walk down. So there's, like, a comic store in the Commons. It's still there, I think.
It is still there.
And then I'd, like, sneak the comics back into my dorm room and, like, hopefully nobody would, like, watch me read them for fear of, like, not having any more friends. But now it's very popular, so that's good. So, you know, it's a lifelong passion of mine is comic books and, you know, superhero storytelling and, like, the kind of modern myths that thankfully, like I just said, it's, like, more people care about more now and can really talk about it. I had been going to Comic-Con with a Cornell friend, actually, Brad Werner, for like 10 years, or no, about 6 years. And I'd had a short film. It goes to show you, like, kind of, you have to put your foot out there and the kind of we'll figure it out. And we did a short film that was actually a branded film that was a comedy. I'd entered into Comic-Con because I thought it was kind of pop culture related, adjacent, and it got into this comic book film festival in San Diego. Comic-Con's a really big, I don't know, for people, listeners don't know, it's the largest comic convention in the United States. It's like hundreds of thousands of people in San Diego every year. And we got it in. I'd always wanted to go. So Brad and I, like, you know, paid our way, went there, like, found like an Airbnb or before Airbnb, whatever it was, somewhere to just crash. And then I ran into a friend from high school I hadn't seen in, you know, decades. And her boyfriend, but now husband at the time, he was working with Stan and as sort of his mentor.
Wow.
And then, you know, years went by. We started a friendship. I met Stan, and he had been working with, they've been working together on this idea and, like, kind of batting back and forth, like, you know, should we do something together? Should we not? And then Luke Lieberman, who's my friend from Comic-Con, invited me in to collaborate with him and Stan and create this new universe called Alliances. And then over the course of 5 years, we developed these characters and these storylines. And at some point, Stan had decided that, like, you know, we were ready to sort of introduce the stories. And, you know, as Stan was known for his sort of always being on the cutting edge, he, you know, saw audio as a really intimate format to introduce his readership and his fans to these new stories. And I think it was a really good choice, and Audible was really supportive. And the Audible original is with Yara, I think, really gives shape to what Stan was looking to do, which is to tell a story about, like, what is more real, the world we occupy or the world we create for ourselves. And, you know, Stan, his whole thing was always like, what if? And, you know, for years and decades, for my whole life, he was my mentor virtually. It's funny, we should talk about virtual. And then, you know, came, you know, one in person, and then we got to do this collaboration together. And, you know, unfortunately, he wasn't here for the release. And that's the thing, you know, we miss him for. But, you know, he was there through the completion of the manuscript. And that's, you know, it's really been a wonderful experience because, you know, we get to engage with his fan base and, you know, new fans. And he hadn't really worked in publishing either. And this was, you know, one of his first long form novels. So it was a really cool thing to be able to do something new with somebody who was already a master of storytelling at, you know, 90 something years old.
I love it. I mean, I think it speaks to just his own skill, as you mentioned as well, too. I think for me, what Marvel and Stan Lee's writing was always talking about, like, the outsider and that what if, right? Like, whose voice isn't here, and what voice could we be sharing, and what does that mean to be an outsider in that space as well, too? I think that's been really fascinating for me.
That is a good way to look at it, because it was about being the outsider and his curiosity, going back to the idea of curiosity. You know, the Fantastic Four actually landed in Ithaca. It's not in the first issue, and I'm actually not sure which issue makes it canon. But for some reason, and I never asked Stan this, but why that is, but he landed them in Ithaca. So, you know, Fantastic Four goes up to the cosmic rays. And what's amazing about Stan is, like, his, again, the what if is never so far from reality itself. So, like, yeah. In our world, we're dealing, in Trick of Light, we're dealing with questions about technology and the internet yep. and connectivity, tribalism, and all these kinds of things. And the power and the disconnection and loneliness that can come from this. And then the impact that technology can have on us, but in a, you know, sci-fi way. In this Fantastic Four and the Hulk, he's looking at things about the nuclear age and the cosmic space race. And, you know, we hadn't even been to the moon at the point in which Stan sent, you know, the Reed Richards and Sue Storm up wow. there. And, you know, he had to visualize that with Kirby, and he got it pretty accurate, you know, like, and it's, you know, but then he took it to a fantastical place. But the reality was, it was about like a nuclear family who sent up into space, and then the kind of trials and tribulations of their life that come after that. But it's also the questions of, like, you know, really Reed is looking at, I mean, this is why Fantastic Four is probably his great American novel. Although we wrote, you know, he wrote a novel for Trick of Light, but I mean, really Fantastic Four explores over the course of 100 issues, so many themes in a comic, in a really unapologetic comic book way, which I think is what's great about those stories. Oh, yeah. You know?
Totally. I mean, I think that's the great thing about these things, right? Like, good fiction is grounded in a little bit of reality, right? Like, fiction allows us to explore real themes in a way that we might not necessarily be able to feel comfortable talking about it in a truth or in a realistic kind of way as well, too. And I think that's the thing I appreciate about these stories is, as mentioned, like X-Men, you know, A Trick of Light, these stories yeah. allow us to explore themes that are happening in our daily lives without necessarily having to fully confront what's happening with us. And that allows us to explore it in a different way and kind of come back to reality a little bit more educated in a different way.
Well, this is why I think all of, you know, and the tech world really borrowed a lot of this. But I mean, yeah. storytelling is so important just because, like you said, it creates sense out of the chaos. And like, that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be, you know, some mystery film noir or sci-fi superhero punch 'em up. It can be anything. It could be, you know, your CEO giving a keynote speech like Steve Jobs would used to give. Yeah. It's like, he was the master storyteller of our generation. It's the same as, you know, John Lennon was, you know, in music back in the day, because you know, he knew how to tell a great story. And and I think without somebody like Jobs, Apple is still very innovative, but it doesn't have that narrative storytelling. Like, sure. I don't get the sense when I'm using my iPhone that I'm creating a narrative for myself the way that, you know, we used to have when, you know, Jobs was with us unveiling technology. Oh, so yeah. There's some really great storytellers out there that are not just filmmakers or authors or whatever.
I like it too. I mean, I think that's, so one of the questions I have for you is, well, you know, you talked about like sneaking off downtown, going to Comic-Con. I think, you know, the comic universe in that space is just kind of growing in popular culture as well too. How do you feel like yeah. that's changed over time? And how do you think that's affected, you know, the universe that's being created? It's not just, I think, you know, for nerdy guys with glasses, it's a democratized space where everyone's kind of welcome into this comic book and, you know, superhero kind of world.
I mean, it's good by me. I like it because, you know, finally I can have, you know, what's great about pop culture is that everybody has a passion about something, like, yeah. and we don't all share the same passion. So, I mean, you know, I'm a massive Doctor Who fan, but I'm not the biggest, I don't have like the largest knowledge base around it. Right. So you can get into a conversation with somebody who's like diehard Doctor Who and can go full on in. Right. And that's fun because it's a shared, and I think especially now pop culture is very important because of the way we are all sort of, like you said, like virtual learning yeah. and virtual workspaces. We can share in sort of common myth. And I think what's cool now isn't just that we're sharing in common American myths. I think we're sharing in common myths, period. And like, yeah. you know, we see Parasite in my business and the film business, yep. you know, take over the Oscars. This is great because, you know, that question of class warfare is a modern myth. That's not just unique to South Korea. So, that's what's really, I think, going to be the next generation. It's going to really, I'm really excited about that. And that's actually one of the things we were excited to do with Alliances with Stan. And Stan was really excited about is making this as global as possible and realistically global as possible, because storytelling has no boundaries anymore.
Yeah.
or fewer boundaries in most countries.
I love that. You know, when you think about kind of where storytelling is going next, what are some stories that you wish are being told that you don't currently see as often? And I don't say, I'll limit it first, just kind of our own pop culture here in the US.
Yeah, you know, I wish that movie specifically, there's so much opportunity with like a Marvel or a DC or any of the major pop culture universe brands, let's just call them. There's so much opportunity to say something about the world or actually do it like a genre movie, like a real genre, like hardcore genre. And I think they kind of are trying that with Deadpool to a certain degree. And but a lot of it seems like it's more marketing based than actual, yeah. Like they say Captain America was like a spy movie, and those movies are great and like built off of like 60s, 70s movies. And like, yeah, kind of, it's like close, but like, I almost want them to go like full tilt. Like I would love to see like and I know they may be trying this, but like a proper X-Men horror movie, you know, like why not? Because you have, or even in an opposite of the genre, like say something really meaningful about the world, because you're going to have the audience no matter what.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't matter. Like they're going to come to the Superman movie no matter what. So like take a chance with it and then be a little bit more risky. I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen.
Yeah. A lot of what was interesting, like The Mandalorian for me is a good example of that, right? Like you hear it take Star Wars, but then you plant it into the Western genre. And I thought that was a real good play on both of things, right? And here it's a full on genre movie, as you mentioned, and it's super successful. It's like, it's a different take at this built world.
Well, what I like about that too, it's like, you know, it encourages fans to then go back like and look at where things came from. Because like The Mandalorian is a good example. Like now people can go experience like, you know, the man who shot Liberty Valance in a new light. So it doesn't feel like a quote unquote, like old movie. And I think that's going to be really important moving forward, is like keeping track of like all of our cultural history. Cause as things go digital, like, and as it becomes like, you can't even count how many shows are made a year or how many books are published a year anymore. Like we're going to lose track of like some of our shared cultural history. And that's like, I don't love that idea. So I really think it's important that that we take opportunities to introduce people to the past. And Scorsese and Tarantino were very good at that. You know, when they make their movies.
What's a genre you'd like to make in a different universe that hasn't been made yet before?
A genre in a specific universe. Well, the horror X-Men movie, I think, would be like super, super proper. But I think they may try that. That's just in the Marvel world. But I would love like to see like a Star Wars horror movie. Like that would be really cool. Huh. Like a full on one.
Kind of like the Dianoga from the trash compactor coming up on things. Like that's now you're seeing my inner Star Wars nerd just pop out.
Yeah. Exactly. And I also think you can take more risks, like put out more like, you know, shorter pieces of content, longer form ones. You know, I think there's just a lot of opportunity in those spaces. But in terms of like, so what was the question? I kind of didn't really answer it.
So what genre
I want?
Yeah, right. So like The Mandalorian is like Star Wars, but it's a Western. What would you do? Like what's a universe and what would you do in a new kind of genre in that universe?
I have to think about that. That's an interesting challenge you've given to me.
Well, while you mull on that one, we'll shift gears a little bit. You know, one of the things, you're a dedicated Cornell alumnus as well too, involved in several different committees, giving back in many different ways. Let's talk a little bit how you give back to Cornell and to the world at large too. What are some of the ways that you're currently volunteering with Cornell?
Well, I think one of the, like for me, Cornell is a like a lifetime family. And I think what's great about that, it's like the family you choose, but also kind of like the family Cornell chose for you. So it's like this like kind of strange, like mix. It's kind of like the perfect match. But my my volunteer work, and I'll be honest, because I think maybe, I don't know who the listenership is, but I mean, I was not always involved. Like I was involved when I was a student in certain organizations. I wasn't like the super involved person. I just kind of did, you know, things here and there, ambassadorships, this, that, and the other. And I always felt a little bit guilty about it. So then like I disconnected from university after I left, and I wasn't super involved in anything. And I think what was great is that like Cornell is a place that you can always come back to. And like, almost like you could, it's the same thing I was saying. It's like kind of, you get there and it's a little bit overwhelming. Like you have so many choices and you don't know what to do, but like just find a couple of things and you'll be fine. You can't do everything, but find the things that interest you. It kind of works the same way with volunteerism. Like I thought I was out, and then I was out. And then like I started like dipping my toe back in with the Cornell comm department. And then I worked my way kind of like outward from there. And I volunteer, I'm on the advisory board for a comm, and we started about 10 years ago, and I've been, you know, with them for quite a bit, several terms. And I come up regularly to teach or guest lecture, or do fireside chats like in the dorms, which I love. And you know, I think it's important to share a varied experience, business experience, with students, because there's a tendency, which when I was there and certainly now, where it seems like there's like a limitation on like what you can do with a Cornell degree to a certain degree. It's like, you're like, have to either get recruited in your senior or junior year to like an internship or whatever. And then if you don't do that, like, you have it in your head like you failed. It doesn't make any sense. And I experienced that. So I take a lot of pride and I take a lot of effort and a lot of energy and effort into trying to destigmatize that aspect of the Cornell experience, because I don't find it to be the best. And I don't know why even that exists. It's like groupthink in a weird way. It's from like to 6,000 people like at a given moment. Doesn't make sense. But so I volunteer at the comm department. I go up there for job camp every year, and for our advisory board meeting. I'm a member of Cornell Council, which is, you know, for the listener that don't know, is ambassadors, 300 or so ambassadors selected by the university for their leadership. You know, and meets once a year during trustee council weekend. I'm trying to be more involved with the WVBR folks. Again, like it was in my mind, you know, especially when you move forward in your work, you start thinking like, what were like the seminal things that really worked for me? And like, you want to be able to give back to those. I like to look forward, but I always like to think about like who got me even a small part of the way here. And, you know, I'm doing a lot of audio work now. And I was like, I worked at WVBR for maybe a semester.
Yeah.
But that was really important for me because like, I didn't seem like, you know, I wasn't like a leadership role at WVBR, but it taught me, you know, about radio, and it got me speaking into a microphone, even though I was like pretty, you know, timid in freshman year. And I thought it was important to like start giving back and being involved with that. So like, you know, I'm slowly but surely finding my way among the Cornellians and in the volunteer space.
I would say that's, I think, the common thread I've heard as well, too, is that people often think of volunteering as this huge commitment, but really you just find things that are of interest to you and you realize it's not as big as you might think it might be. And you give back, and it really gives back to you in a lot of different ways as well, too.
Mentorship is one of the, is so important. I mean, it can create, it really opens up the doors for so many things. And mentorship goes both ways, as I've learned. Like I've given as much to my mentors as they've given to me, and mentees have given as much to me as I've given to them, and vice versa. Sometimes just by like sending an email. Like, I mean, I will respond to emails to like people who, you know, are looking for mentorship. And I think most people do. Like, I don't think it's that hard. It just requires putting yourself out, which is very hard.
Yeah.
Like that emotionally is very hard.
I think there's also, Cornell actually started an easy like e-mentoring platform as well too, where students can sign up and literally just like send out questions, connect with people, you know, either linking them through LinkedIn or just through this platform as well too. So lots of different ways for students to connect and for folks to give back. I think As you mentioned too, you talked a little about like everyone else is doing all these different things, it seems like, on campus, and you don't feel like you're doing enough. And I think one of the things that we try and do on this podcast with the people I've interviewed is, you know, if you might have heard of the imposter syndrome, I think the last guest I spoke with, we're trying to find a better name for it as well too, where everyone else seems to be doing amazing things, and it's like, am I really doing enough? And I think, you know, by virtue of being a student there, you're doing a lot and you're doing enough. And you know, your path might lead you in different ways. And just because you're not getting 8 internships as a freshman doesn't necessarily mean you won't be successful kind of later in your career as well too.
Oh yeah, no, my internships had nothing to do with, it just taught me what I didn't want to do probably.
I think that's a good thing, right? Like internships, you'd rather know what you don't want to do rather than thinking, all right, it's not a waste of your 2 months. It's like, all right, I know that that is not a place I want to be.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're coming up at the end of our time here. The last two questions I want to ask you, I've been doing overrated, underrated with folks. So for you, I'm going to talk about film specifically. What's an overrated film in your opinion and an underrated film in your opinion?
Overrated movies, there are only good movies. Like it's just about your experience with it. But an underrated movie, that I like to point people to is Lives of Others. It was known it's an international movie, German film, but set about in surveillance culture. But I think that film is just, it's a terrific look at like just humanity, and it's a great thriller, but it's a fun surveillance mystery movie. In terms of overrated movies, oh man, I need to look at the IMDb list. What's on there? Is there anything? I mean, I'll tell you what, like there's certain movies that don't hold up that hold, like have such a tremendous meaningful experience to me because we had limited, I mean, maybe you don't remember this time, but like, we didn't have access to every movie ever made. So we only had like TNT or HBO, and like something was on repeat because we stole the cable. Yeah. Like a box that don't, like, was stolen or like we cracked. And you know, like movies like Rima Williams, like that doesn't hold up at all. That is a incredibly racist, insensitive film. So like that doesn't hold up, but like people love that movie because it's like part of their like nostalgia. But you know, a movie that people that I love, and I think people like that has a small cult following, is Only the Strong, which is always on HBO, and Vision Quest. But these are movies that like people herald as like being these amazing films. But if you watch them now, you're like, oh man, they're not as good as they were when I was a kid.
I could do a whole episode with you too, I feel, about like on how movies change over time, like just things don't hold up. Like I talked about like Song of the South with someone, and I'm like, there's some racist things in this movie. Like, what is this?
I think Iger said that he's never releasing that movie on Disney Plus, which I think is a very good thing. I mean, it is like, and it's unfortunate because they're part of like, again, like they're part of our shared history. Like you kind of like remember those movies in a different way. And then you're like, holy moly. Like that is, those are not well rendered characters at all.
That's a good talk, right? It's like, how do we not forget about these things, but put in a modern context as well too, and understand what they were for their time and what they shouldn't be now.
But that's part of like telling a story. Like Stan's story stand the test of time because he did not draw upon like cultural stereotypes, or he tried not to as much as he could. Like, and I think it's when you lean into a stereotype and don't actually give anybody their full dimension of a character, which amazingly you could do in a comic book in the 60s. You know, that's when you get into real trouble.
I love it. So my very last question for you here, you get to create a new course at Cornell. What would it be and why?
Oh, I get to create courses at Cornell?
Yeah, that's the power I have as a podcast host today.
Ooh, wow. I would like, I mean, there's so many things I would like. I would just like basic, like life math, I would call it. Like the math I did at Cornell was like very high end finance, like stuff that I've never had to use ever again. But like, yet I have trouble like calculating, you know, like food grams versus ounces. And I'm sure there's a cooking class that I could have taken, but that could have just been like the cooking part could have been like one class of the course of like, just like life math. but maybe I'm just making myself look like I'm ignorant about certain things.
Well, I'm gonna look into that class now. I think that'll be something I add onto my course roster here. But always good to learn those new things too. Yeah. Ryan, again, it's been great to chat with you. I've learned a lot. I think I'm gonna have to go with you to the next Comic-Con. I wasn't able to go last year, but I try and go every year. And I'm gonna definitely talk to you more about some of these movie stuff. I feel like I could talk to you about that stuff for hours as well too.
Great.
So thanks again to Academy Award-winning filmmaker Ryan Silber, founder of Origin Story Entertainment. Again, you can catch Ryan's latest project, Stan Lee's Alliances, A Trick of Light. It's an original audio storytelling event from Amazon's Audible Studios and starring Gronish's Yara Shahidi. But again, thank you everyone for listening. Be sure to like, rate, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find out more about young alumni programs and how to get involved at alumni.cornell.edu/young-alumni. And by following our Facebook page, Cornell Young Alumni Programs. Music from Fresh for the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013. And you can contact him at koa3@cornell.edu. If you have questions or ideas about the podcast for future, you can email our awesome producer, Amanda, at amanda.massa, M-A-S-S-A, at cornell.edu. Thanks again, listeners, and we'll catch you again soon on another episode of Fresh from the Hill. Thanks and goodbye.